Hi everyone, welcome back to hands-free studying for the MBE with Brainscape. Today's video is about contract law. So get ready and let's get started with our first set of cards covering formation.
Question one, define contract. A contract is a legally enforceable agreement. Question two, what are the types of laws that govern contracts? The first is the common law, which applies to employment contracts and personal service contracts, for example. The second is UCC Article 2, which governs anything movable, as well as tangible personal property. Now, when the contract deals with both goods and services, the predominant purpose of the contract reigns when determining whether to apply common law or UCC. Question three, what are the elements needed to form a valid contract? All right, first you need to have mutual assent, which is an offer plus acceptance. Two, you need to have consideration, which is a bargained for legal detriment. And three, there must be no defenses to formation. Question four, define bilateral contract. A bilateral contract is a contract made by both sides. In other words, both sides have promised to do something. Question five, define unilateral contract. A unilateral contract is one that requires full performance as the method of acceptance. Question six, define offer. An offer is an outward, objective manifestation of willingness to enter into a bargain that creates the power of acceptance in the offeree. In other words, there's nothing left to do except say yes. Question seven, under common law, what terms must be included in the offer? Parties, subject matter, price, and quantity. Question eight, what terms are required for real estate contracts? Real estate contracts must contain the identity of the land as well as price terms. Question nine, what terms are required for UCC contracts? The only required term for a UCC contract is quantity. As long as the parties intended to make a contract, the UCC will supply gap fillers for missing terms. Question 10. What terms are required for a requirement or output contract? A requirement or output contract must contain the quantity expressed in terms such as all, or only, or solely. These upcoming questions are related to the contract law topics, defenses to formation and enforceability. Let's get started. Question one, what is a void contract? A void contract is when the entire contract is void and non-existent. Question two, what is a voidable contract? A voidable contract is a valid contract unless one party seeks to void it. Question three, what is an unenforceable contract? An unenforceable contract is a valid contract that cannot be enforced if one party halts performance. Question four, what are the 10 defenses to contract formation and enforceability? Okay, one, incapacity, two, misrepresentation, three, duress, four, undue influence, five, unconscionability, six, illegality, seven, public policy, 8, statute of frauds. 9, misunderstanding. And 10, mistake. Question 5. What are the 3 types of incapacity? 1, incapacity due to being a minor or infant. 2, mental incompetence. Or 3, intoxication. All right, question 6. Who can void a contract with a minor? The minor only. The other party cannot void the contract and the minor can enforce it against the other party. If, however, the minor lied about his age, the other party can seek to void it on grounds of fraud. Question 7. Can a minor void a contract for necessities? No. A minor cannot void a contract for necessities, meaning clothing, shelter, food, or medical expenses. The minor must pay for them. All right, question 8. If a minor breaches a contract for necessities, what can the other party recover? The other party can recover a reasonable value of the goods under the quasi-contract theory. Question 9. Can a minor choose to enforce a contract? Yes, a minor can enforce a contract if these 3 elements exist. 1, the minor entered into the contract before adulthood. 2, the minor has now reached adulthood. And 3, the minor ratifies the contract either implicitly by failing to disavow the contract after reaching adulthood, explicitly, meaning orally or through writing, or by conduct, meaning that the minor encourages the other party to perform and a mutual exchange begins. Question 10. When is a person considered mentally incompetent to enter into a contract? A person is considered mentally incompetent when they either 1, fail to comprehend the contract, or comprehend the contract, but they act in an unreasonable manner, and the other party knows that that person is acting unreasonably. These upcoming questions are related to the contract law topic on the statute of frauds. Let's get started. Question 1. Define the statute of frauds. The statute of frauds holds that some contracts are unenforceable unless they are in writing. Question 2. To satisfy the statute of frauds, what does the writing need to contain? The writing needs to contain, 1st, the essential elements of the deal, and 2nd, be signed by the party asserting the statute of frauds defense. Note, the writing does not need to be formal and can be done during or after the contract formation. Question 3. When does performance satisfy the statute of frauds? Performance satisfies the statute of frauds only for certain types of contracts. This includes, 1st, service contracts, where only full performance satisfies the statute of frauds. 2, for specially manufactured goods, for which delivery satisfies the statute of frauds. And then also for real estate contracts, if the buyer does 2 of the 3 following acts, either fully or partially paying the purchase price, possessing the property, or improving the property. If 2 out of those 3 things are done, then performance has satisfied the statute of frauds. Question 4. What are the 6 types of contracts that are subject to the statute of frauds? 1st, marriage contracts. 2, contracts that cannot be performed within a year. 3, land interests, meaning real estate sales and leases that are less than a year. 2, any sort of executor contract. 5, suretyship contracts. And 6, contracts for the sale of goods for a price 500 or more. Question 5. Does mutual promise to marry, without consideration, fall within the statute of frauds? No. Only marriage promises made in consideration of the marriage fall within the statute of frauds. For example, prenup agreements. Let's take a quick break for a study tip. Now, I know you probably don't need to hear this, but have you done any exercise today? Even just a few minutes of air squats, push-ups, or planks can juice your brain power and help this knowledge stick much better. Let's get back to questions 6 through 10. Question 6. For contracts incapable of being performed within a year, when does the one-year period start? The one-year period starts from the date of the contract execution, not the date the performance started. Question 7. What's the key question to ask when determining whether a contract falls within the one-year rule? The key question to ask is, do the express terms of the contract make it impossible for it to be completed within a year? If yes, then the statute of frauds applies. Question 8. What happens if a contract is fully or partially performed before the 1 year is up? If there has been full performance, then the statute of frauds no longer applies. However, if there's only been partial performance, then the statute of frauds still applies, but restitution is available. Question 9. Is a lifetime employment contract subject to the statute of frauds? No, because the employee could die before the end of the year. The contract could technically be performed within 1 year. Lastly, question 10. What is suretyship and what's the main purpose rule? Suretyship is a contract that promises to pay the debts of a third party. The main purpose rule states that if the surety agreement is for the surety's own economic benefit, then it does not fall within the statute of frauds. These upcoming questions are related to the contract law topic, contract interpretation. Let's get started. Question 1. Define the parole evidence rule. The parole evidence rule bars admission of extrinsic evidence of prior or contemporaneous agreements or dealings that contradict or supplement the terms of integrated contracts. Question 2. Define an integrated contract. An integrated contract is one that the parties intended to be the final expression of their agreement. Question 3. What is a partially integrated contract? A partially integrated contract is one that expresses the party's final agreement about some terms, but not all of the terms. Question 4. What is a merger clause? A merger clause states that the contract contains the complete and entire agreement of the parties. A merger clause is evidence of total integration. Question 5. What constitutes prior dealings for the purposes of the parole evidence rule? Prior dealings include oral negotiations and agreements made prior to the contract, as well as any written agreements prior to the contract. Keep up the good work, everyone. We're going to take a quick study break to remind you that if you ever feel like you're behind, just remember that tons of law students aren't studying right this minute, but you are. Momentum and daily habits are everything, so keep it up. And let's get through questions 6 through 10. Question 6. Does parole evidence bar the admission of subsequent agreements? No. The parties can always modify the contract. Question 7. When does the parole evidence rule not apply? In other words, when can you introduce extrinsic evidence? You can introduce extrinsic evidence in a few different scenarios. The first is if the contract was only partially integrated. The second is if you need to show that the contract does not exist or was never formed. The third is you can introduce extrinsic evidence as a defense to enforceability. Fourth, to resolve ambiguities. Fifth, to prove a condition precedent. Sixth, to supplement or explain terms with evidence of either trade usage or past dealings. And remember, this is for UCC 2-202 sale of goods contracts only. And lastly, you can introduce extrinsic evidence to help the court interpret the contract by showing the party's subjective understanding of the terms. Question 8. What is the UCC's approach to extrinsic evidence? The UCC presumes that contracts are partially integrated, meaning they allow the addition of non-contradictory terms unless the parties would have certainly included them. And this is in UCC 2-202. Question 9. What are the four sources that courts use to interpret contracts? Courts look at 1. The express terms, 2. Course of performance, 3. Course of dealing, and 4. Trade usage. Question 10. Rank the following from most important to least important for contract interpretation. Course of dealing, trade usage, course of performance, and express terms. First, for the most important, courts look at the express terms. Then they look at course of performance, then course of dealing, and then least important, they look at trade usage. These upcoming questions are related to contract law, performance, breach, and discharge topics. All right, let's get started. Question 1. Define condition. A condition is an action or event that is required to take place before performance is triggered or due. Question 2. What is the difference between a condition and a promise? A condition is dependent on other events to trigger the act or performance. For example, if you clean your room, then I will take you out for pizza. A promise, however, does not depend on other events or actions to trigger duties. So for example, saying, I promise to take you out for pizza next Thursday. Question 3. Define condition precedent. A condition precedent is one that must take place before performance or another event is triggered. For example, Max will take Kathy on a trip to Europe if he passes the bar exam. Question 4. Define condition subsequent. In a condition subsequent, performance is not excused until after the event occurs. So for example, Max will continue taking the bar exam until he passes it. Question 5. Define concurrent condition. A concurrent condition is one in which each party is required to perform at the same time. Question 6. Define an express condition. An express condition is one that is expressly included in the contract as a condition. So look for language such as on the condition that. Question 7. If the satisfaction of one party is listed as an express condition, what standard is used? The standard used is an objective, reasonable person standard. Question 8. If an express condition is the aesthetic taste of one party, what standard is used? The subjective good faith standard. Question 9. At common law, if one party's performance is subject to an express condition, what's the result if that condition does not occur? The party who would have benefited from the condition is discharged from their performance obligations, unless there was either waiver, bad faith conduct, or forfeiture or great loss may result to one of the parties. Question 10. At common law, under what three circumstances can a failed express condition be excused? The first is waiver. The party who would have been discharged by the condition's failure may waive that right and perform anyway, making their obligations absolute. Or second, by bad faith conduct. This will excuse a condition if the benefiting party fails to take steps reasonably necessary for the condition to be met or interferes with the fulfillment of the contract. And lastly, an express condition can be excused to avoid forfeiture. A court may excuse a condition if the fulfillment of that condition would cause one of the parties great loss or forfeiture. These upcoming questions are related to contract law UCC performance concepts. Let's get started. Question 1. What is a seller's obligation under the UCC? A seller is obligated to transfer and deliver the goods sold. Question 2. What are carrier cases? Carrier cases are when the parties to a contract agree to use a specified common carrier, a transporter, to deliver the goods. Question 3. When does the risk of loss transfer from the seller to the buyer in 1. Shipment contracts and then 2. In destination contracts? For shipment contracts, the risk of loss is transferred to the buyer once the seller delivers goods to the common carrier. So once UPS gets the goods, then the buyer bears the risk of loss. For destination contracts, however, the risk of loss is only transferred to the buyer when the goods are delivered at the buyer's destination. Question 4. What is FOB, seller's place of business, mean? This means that it's a shipment contract, meaning that the risk of loss passes to the buyer once the seller delivers goods to the common carrier and arranges for their shipment. Question 5. What does FOB, buyer's place of business, mean? This means that it's a destination contract, meaning that the risk of loss passes to the buyer after the goods are tendered at the destination point. Okay, let's take a quick study break to remind you to breathe deep through your abdomen, not swallow through your chest. The more oxygen that you can get in with each breath, the better memory retention you'll have. All right, let's get back to questions 6 through 10. Question 6. What are non-carrier cases? Non-carrier cases are when the parties do not agree to use a common carrier to deliver the goods. Question 7. In non-carrier cases, who bears the risk of loss? The answer hinges on whether the seller is a merchant. So if the seller is not a merchant, then the risk of loss passes to the buyer upon tender of delivery. Now, only tender of delivery is required, not actual receipt by the buyer. However, if the seller is a merchant, then the risk of loss passes to the buyer only when the buyer physically takes possession of the goods. Now, remember that risk of loss can also be specified in the contract, or borne by the breaching party if there is a breach. Question 8. When can a party request an assurance of performance? A party can request an assurance of performance if anticipatory repudiation cannot be established, but there are some reasonable grounds for insecurity. Question 9. When can a party suspend performance after failing to receive adequate assurances? Under UCC 2-209, a party can suspend performances if the other party doesn't respond to the demand within a reasonable time, which is 30 days under the UCC, or they don't respond in a way that provides reasonable assurances. Lastly, question 10. What is the perfect tender rule? The perfect tender rule requires absolute perfect tender of goods as specified in the contract. The perfect tender rule does not apply to installment contracts or when the parties agree otherwise. These upcoming questions are related to contract law, third-party beneficiary concepts. Let's get started. Question 1. Define third-party beneficiary. A third-party beneficiary is a person who is not a party to the contract, but the contract still benefits. Question 2. What are the types of beneficiaries in both the first and second restatement? In the first restatement, there are 3 types of third-party beneficiaries. First, creditors. Second, donee. And third, incidental. In the second restatement, there are only 2. The first is incidental third-party beneficiaries, which includes creditors and donees, and then second, intended third-party beneficiaries. Question 3. Define creditor beneficiary. A creditor beneficiary is a third-party beneficiary of the contract. Here, the promisee seeks performance by the promisor to fulfill an obligation owed to the third-party creditor beneficiary. Question 4. Define donee beneficiary. A donee beneficiary is a third-party beneficiary to the contract. Here, the promisee seeks performance from the promisor in order to make a gift to the third-party donee beneficiary. Question 5. What is an incidental beneficiary? An incidental beneficiary is a third party who benefits from the performance of the contract, even though the benefit to them wasn't the party's primary intent in forming the contract. In other words, the benefit to them is incidental to the contract. Question 6. What are the incidental beneficiary's rights under the contract? An incidental beneficiary does not have any rights to seek enforcement of the contract. Question 7. What is an intended beneficiary? An intended beneficiary is someone for whom the contracting party intended to benefit with the contract. These beneficiaries can seek enforcement of the contract, unlike incidental beneficiaries. Question 8. When does an intended beneficiary have rights to seek enforcement of the contract? Against first, the promisor, and second, against the promisee. First, against the promisor, an intended beneficiary always has the right to seek enforcement of the contract because the promisor is under an obligation to the beneficiary. On the other hand, an intended beneficiary never has rights concerning the enforcement of promised performance under the new contract against the promisee. A third-party beneficiary will only have rights against the promisee if there was some type of prior obligation between the promisee and the third-party beneficiary. Question 9. When do the interests of an intended third-party beneficiary vest? There are four circumstances. First, if the beneficiary sues. Second, if the beneficiary justifiably changes her position of reliance on the contract and notifies the parties. Third, they can vest at the request of the parties if the beneficiary manifests assent to the contract. Or lastly, the interest can vest if the contract's express terms state that the rights have vested. Question 10. What is the consequence of an intended third-party beneficiary's rights vesting? Both parties are now bound to the contract and must gain consent of the beneficiary to modify or rescind the contract. These upcoming questions are related to contract law, remedies, concepts. Let's get started. Question 1. What are three types of compensatory damages? 1. Expectation damages. 2. Reliance damages. And 3. Restitution. Question 2. Define expectation damages. Expectation damages entitle the non-breaching party to whatever amount that would put them in the position that they would have been in if the contract had been fully performed. Question 3. How do you calculate expectation damages? Expectation damages are equal to the loss of value to the non-breaching party plus incidental and consequential damages minus payments and benefits received, plus any costs saved as the result of the breach. Question 4. Can expectation damages be speculative? No, they must be calculated with reasonable certainty. Question 5. Can a court award damages for lost profits? Lost profits, especially with startups and new companies, are usually hard to prove, and thus courts will be very hesitant to award these types of damages. You can seek reliance damages instead. However, just because they're hesitant doesn't mean that courts don't award damages for lost profits. And they're more likely to do so if the aggrieved party has facts to back up their claim for damages, rather than just speculating about what amount they could have made. Question 6. Can you recover damages for partial performance? Yes, you can get damages to compensate for the work performed and expectation damages for the work not yet performed. Question 7. List the four situations in which the aggrieved party may not be able to fully recover expectation damages. 1. If the cost to perform significantly exceeds the market value of such performance. 2. If the party cannot calculate expectation damages with reasonable certainty. 3. If the damages are unforeseeable. And 4. If the damages could have been mitigated or reasonably avoided. Question 8. A buyer of goods under the UCC is entitled to what types of compensatory damages? There are 3: incidental, consequential, and liquidated. Question 9. What are the incidental damages for a buyer of goods? Incidental damages for a buyer of goods are costs that are associated with the breach and mitigation, including transportation, warehouse costs, etc. Question 10. How do you calculate damages for incorrect construction work? If the mistake is material to the contract, meaning it requires fixing, Then you use the amount needed to fix the mistake to calculate damages.
And that's the end of your MBE contract law study round.
To reach full mastery, remember to study in Brainscape. Our mobile and web app uses the latest in spaced repetition techniques, allowing you to optimize your study time and track your progress down to the finest detail. Of course, when you're driving, cooking, exercising, or otherwise unable to navigate the app, be sure to keep listening to the rest of this hands-free studying playlist. No matter what subject you're learning and what method you're studying it, Brainscape helps you rise to your challenge.